This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hello there, everyone, and thank you so much, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Our guest today is one of those musicians you simply have to admire. He and his brother formed the North Mississippi All-Stars in 1996, recording to date 14 albums by my count. He is a former guitarist for the Black Crowes, appearing on five of their albums. He's been in supergroups and has appeared collaboratively on many other albums as well. In 2007, Rolling Stone magazine called him a new guitar god, and in 2014, Gibson issued a signature ES-335 in his name. I guess you could say he's made quite a name for himself, because there's a lot more that I could talk about here. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Luther Dickinson to Time Signatures. How are you, sir?
Very well. Thank you, Jim.
Glad to have you. So, Luther, I have to know where your journey in music began, man, because it seems like you've always been here quietly or not so quietly making your mark.
You know, my brother and I grew up in a musical family, in a musical community. Our father, Jim Dickinson, was a first-generation Memphis rock and roll kid, you know. He sang on the last proper Yellow Label Sun single, you know, and then went on to do folk and roots and soul. And he, golly, he recorded with Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones. I mean, he had an amazing career. So we grew up around Memphis and a bunch of freaks, you know, creatives of all sorts in the Memphis underground. And I do not remember not knowing I was going to be a guitar player. It wasn't natural to me. And Dad was very harsh, like said, you got to keep practicing, man, because you're not hitting on shit. But I think just knowing what you want to do and staying focused can be a great asset, you know, to your journey. And so that's it, man. We just grew up around music and just made our way. You know, right now we're with the Almond Betts Revival, which is so cool because it's the second generation musicians of the Almond Brothers family. Some of them. It's such a huge family. And our dad was friends with he recorded with Duane and worked with Greg later, and they were friends. And to stand toe-to-toe with these second-generation musicians and I grew up loving Allman Brothers. You know, Jimi Hendrix and the Allman Brothers. That's what I grew up on, Jimmy and the brothers.
Now, at the age of 12, your family relocated to the hills of North Mississippi, where you connected with musical families of Otha Turner, R.L. Burnside, and Junior Kimbrough. Talk about keeping good company, man. I'd like to hear a little bit about those guys. What was that like?
That was so fortunate. You know, by the time I was 13 and 14, our dad worked on, I'll try and keep this short, but our dad worked on the Crossroads movie with Ry Cooter, where Ralph Macchio gets the blues, you know? And so at that point in time, before that, the blues was always part of my dad's music. Like, I liked it, but that was like he and his friends. That's what, you know, they grew up around Furry Lewis. They played with Furry, Sleepy John Estes, Buckle White, Fred McDowell. And I liked it, but I didn't identify with it until that movie came out and Dad worked on it. And literally leaving the movie theater, I was like, man, you know, that blues music is kind of cool, man. Can I get some of those tapes, you know? And so I got turned on to all the classic stuff. But growing up, whatever modern contemporary blues through the 80s and 90s, it never turned me on. And then later, we moved to the hills, and I got to know Otha Turner. And then Kenny Brown, who was already a family friend, introduced me to the Burnside family, and we'd start hanging out at Junior Kimbrough's juke joint. So, like, there are these – the hill country was full of musical families just like us. You know, they had a nightclub, and we had a studio. So, man, once we all became friends, we had so much fun, and which led to us starting the North Mississippi All-Stars as a loose collective of musicians, you know. In the hill country repertoire, it's funny because all the families play some of the same songs. Like if you play any function, still to this day down in North Mississippi, there's certain songs that the community wants to hear. And not only does every family play these same songs differently, family members play the same songs differently. You know, it's like a true oral tradition, folk music type of scene. And that just fascinates me and I love it. So we started the band in 96 because I was just, we grew up playing experimental rock and roll of all sorts. But I was just so fascinated and enamored with this music. And that's why we started the All Stars and started playing with Gary and Cedric Burnside and on and on.
And I want to, it's a great springboard into my next question, because I did want to talk to you a little bit about Otha Turner for a moment, because not only was he one of your early influence, you also said that of all the musicians you hung out with back then, he was the one you spent more time with than any other musician. And that's quite a relationship, but talk about that relationship a little bit and the things that you learned by hanging out with him.
My pleasure. I first met Otha when I was 15. We had started, Dad finally begrudgingly started a family band called Jim Dickinson and the Hardly Can Playboys. The Hardly Can Playboys. That was us. And Otha's family was playing the same. It was a annual Memphis Heritage Festival. And so I met him when I was 15 and then 16 again at the same event. And then they invited me down. So I started going down to the rehearsals when I was like 18. And then I started recording them and produced their first, Otha's first record called Everybody Hollering Goat. I couldn't believe that no one had made a record on Otha before. And by that point, I'd started taking my guitar and I was totally studying Mississippi Fred McDowell's music. And I did not know this, but I went down and started playing some Mississippi Fred McDowell for Otha, and he freaked out because they were neighbors and best friends. And Otha was like, I haven't heard anybody play like that since Fred passed away. He couldn't believe it. So Otha started taking me around to his friends to show me off. Like, check out this young kid playing like Fred. And because Otha was a bootlegger, right? So Otha always had a horse and buggy. And so he would pick up Fred Friday afternoons and they would ride around all weekend going to house party to house party, playing and singing blues and selling corn liquor.
So, oh, wow.
And there was some of that going on at Junior Kimbrough's too. Like the music is as if, be it Houston Screwed and Chopped or 60s psychedelic rock, it is drug culture music, which I love. I'm a total sucker for that, you know? Whatever the scene is, be it electronic, dance, ecstasy, or whatever. And but the moonshine is this secret ingredient. So anyway, and Otha, we would sit on his front porch and play guitars. And if I wasn't hitting on shit, man, Otha would be like, he's like, get out of here, man. But if he liked what we were playing, he would start singing. And that was what I lived for. It was like, he was like in his late 80s at that time. And had, you know, to play guitar and have him improvising lyrics, man. And my father said that on that front porch, he thinks that's where I learned how to feel music. And at first, and that's a lifelong journey. I'm still learning about the pocket and being in the moment and in the groove and not rushing. But it's a lifelong study. But I think what he meant really was that if I played well enough, I could conjure up a spirit that Otha would start singing and we would together conjure up another spirit together. And I think that's what he meant, like feel music, like make somebody else feel the music.
Sure.
Enough to make this 80-year-old man start singing, you know what I mean? So, but Otha, man, oh my god. And then when he first heard our band, he took me aside because our first show was in Memphis at the punk rock club, the Antenna Club, and I booked it was Otha Turner, us, and then Arl Burnside with, wow, Kenny Brown and Cedric. And it was our first show and our dad played with us and Cedric played with us. But anyway, Otha took me aside and said, you playing Fred too fast. You playing it too fast. And he was right, but I had to grow into that.
Now, I was reading about your Sacred Steel experience.
So another life changer.
In 2000, you formed an instrumental Sacred Steel gospel blues jam band. I would love to hear a little bit about that. Explain Sacred Steel to me and that project, if you would, please.
You know, it's funny, like, it's like the Live at the Fillmore or the early Jimi Hendrix I got. It's a phenomenon of when an album or a CD comes in your life and literally changes your life, you know, changes the trajectory of your life. Not only your an influence, but literally changes your day-to-day life and your community. And in the late 90s, Arhuli started releasing compilations called Sacred Steel, Volume 1, Volume 2, and then on and on and on. And man, it blew everybody's mind. The first Volume 1, Sacred Steel, is still to this day a classic. Because nobody knew. And so it's a pretty much nationwide community of different churches that the music is based on guitars and lap steels and pedal steels, not organs and pianos. There are no organs and pianos. It's like drums, guitars, and steels. And it's not like country at all. It's the grooviest foot stomping. It's like juke joint dance music, but it's church.
And in a church,
And Robert Randolph. So the first, long story short, the first CD, Sacred Steel, came out. And we were fascinated with it. And then Modesty Barton Wood hired us to open up. And we joined their tour. And they were fascinated with it as well. And we were playing a lot of that music influenced by that style at the time.
Okay.
And so Modesty and I started conjuring up the idea to record a gospel-inspired instrumental record. And so we started talking about it. And then by 2000, it was on the calendar. We had a session booked. So around then, it's a cool story. The Sacred Steel Volume 2 came out, which was all live recordings. And there was track 8 had this young guy that nobody had heard of called Robert Randolph. And we started listening to that song, Without God, before every show on that tour. And then I found out that we have a mutual friend and that he lives in New Jersey, not far from New York City. This is during a tour. So we're working our way towards New York. We get in touch with a mutual friend. We invite Robert to open up our show at the Bowery Ballroom. And he accepts. And it was his first like proper secular gig outside of the church. And Modesky comes. So Modesky's there. Robert and what became the family band open up the show. And we invite him to the session. So a couple of months later, we start recording The Word with Robert. And we've been friends ever since. He's on this tour right now with All the Bets. And it's just a beautiful 25-year-long friendship now. And that Sacred Steel music, that it changed my life, man. And Robert, now there's so much of the old footage on YouTube. We'll stay up all night and eat edibles and watch these old YouTube church services, man. The Sacred Steel is the funkiest music. Like I said, nobody knew. No, it was a total secret just within that church community. It's funny. Robert and I had a van ride once from leaving a festival with Taj Mahal. And at first, Taj was being real quiet. We all were. And then Robert started singing something. And then Taj chimed in. And then Taj said, Robert, and when when that first CD came out, it blew my mind. I could not believe, as much as I love steel guitar, that I did not know about your music. Me, Taj Mahal, did not know about Sacred Steel music all these decades. And I was like, oh my God, even Taj didn't know, you know?
Now, as we mentioned in the opening of the show, Gibson put a signature 335 out, which is no small thing. Wow. How did it feel knowing that you had something on this level with your name on it? And how much did you have to do with the design and development?
I can't remember when, early 2000s, Gibson opened up a factory in Memphis. And man, it was beautiful, man. It was like Gibsons are just raining down from the heavens, man. some of us fortunate Memphis guitar players, we were just like amassed a great collection of outtake guitars, busted, it might have a scratch on it or whatever, a prototype or an experiment. It was a beautiful relationship. And we developed actually two guitars.
Okay.
And the second guitar, by that point, Gibson wouldn't put anybody's name on it unless you were like Slash or Jimmy Page. they kind of changed the parameters of artist series, but we did two that were kind of opposites. I wanted to make an electric guitar feel like an open tune country blues acoustic that you could finger pick and slide on, like an acoustic guitar, but at high volume with like Jimi Hendrix type of feedback sustain. That was what I was going for back in the day. So we were trying to get that. And we made a 335 with P90s and a Bigsby. That was the LD1. And then so it was a semi-hollow with the P90 pickups. And that was a beautiful guitar. We copied the finish of my dad's old Gibson 175. And that was the Luther Dickinson model. Then we did a full scale 330, which is fully hollow with humbuckers and a Bigsby. And it became the 330L, because it was fully hollow. So it's a 330, but it was long.
Okay.
But I always say that L stands for Luther, because we definitely designed it. It was like the yin and the yang. One was a semi-hollow 335 with P90s. The other was a fully hollow with humbuckers. And man, both beautiful guitars. And yeah, what an honor. My dear friend Mike Boltz, he was working with Gibson at the time. And he definitely made all that happen. And we took a lot of care to get the neck right and get the finishes right. And It was a beautiful time.
I was going to say, what was that like, having a product in your hand that you basically helped design and bring to fruition? How did that feel to you?
It was really cool, man. It was such an honor, you know. But I have to tell you, man, music is ever humbling, you know. There's nothing that you can really let yourself become inflated by, you know, because no matter who you think you are, how bad you think you are, something is going to happen that will like put you right back in your place, man, because you just really have to be the humble servant to music, man. It's like Eric Gale says, Eric Gale calls it the L, you know, it comes from above through us to the people. And we have to stay present and practice just so we can execute just the communal vibrations as best as we can, you know, because so can't let any of it go to your head, you know.
Right. Now, 2025 has been a busy year for you as a member of the North Mississippi All-Stars, but also as a solo artist. NMA is still shaken, as I understand. It's a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the release of your first album, Shake Hands with Shorty, and that came out in June, correct?
Yes, that's right. It was a fun record.
Now, it looks like you've had quite a few special guests on this one.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's like a normal thing for you, though, isn't it?
You know, we really did live up to my initial idea for the band of being a loose collective. You know, I always looked at P-Funk or even our father's band, Mudhorn the Neutrons, you know, like a rotating cast of characters. And, you know, to come back to Robert Randolph and Sacred Steel, the musicians we've been working with the last few years, Joey Williams of the Blind Boys of Alabama on guitar and bass and vocals, and Ray Ray Holloman, he plays guitar for Eminem and Neo, and he plays bass and guitar and sings as well. And Robert introduced us to both of those gentlemen. And man, we're a trio. When we can't afford it, we're a quartet with all of us, and they're just lovely musicians, man. Love working with them, and they contributed so much to the record. And it was fortunate because, like, usually for us, a record is a snapshot of where we were when and who we were with when we made the record.
Yes,
but
sir.
these guys not only contributed to the record, but were able to tour the record as well. So it is really beautiful.
Very cool. Now, as we turn the page once again, we need to talk about another new album. And this one is a solo project. Dead Blues Volume 1 was released mid-October. So just a few weeks ago, actually. And it's another collaborative effort with Datrian Johnson. This one, like the rest, also features guest appearances from your NMA bandmates as well. Talk about this album for a minute, if you would, please.
Sure. I wanted to make an instrumental record where I didn't play guitar. I wrote everything on bass and keyboards and had my friends play drums and guitars.
Okay.
And so I pretty much finished the record and just put it aside. I didn't know what would be a good outlet for an instrumental record, you know. It's just something I did for fun. But then New West Records hit me up about doing a Dead tribute album. And at first I was like, yikes, I don't know. But then I eventually thought, well, Graham Lesh, Phil's son, he and I we used to do it with Phil and friends. I was working for Phil off and on starting in 2012, maybe 11 okay. or 12. And it dawned on me, sorry, this is a long story, but
it dawned on me, you're fine.
Working for Phil that they did so many classic blues songs. And we started booking shows called Dead Blues as a vehicle to get Phil to widen his gene pool. You know, we would do a Dead Blues show and invite, we did a show with Blind Boys of Alabama, JD Simo, Charlie Musselwhite, G-Love, Devin Allman, so many outside musicians, Junior Mack, Tash Neal, Roosevelt, the Sacred Steel player. And it was really fun because we would all just take turns singing these blues standards with Phil. So it dawned on me, I was like, wait a minute, okay, maybe I could do a Dead Blues record for New West, you know, of the blues songs. And I was like, oh, that put that aside. I was like, okay, well, you know, I got to figure out the right cast of characters and the right strategy for that time and place. Then one day I woke up and I was like, oh my God, Datrian. Medeski had brought Datrian into the community. They became friends, and Medeski brought Datrian to some word shows with Robert Randolph. And Datrian and I hit it off, and he is just a beautiful cooperator and collaborator and soul brother, you know, and a wonderful singer. And so we became friends. I woke up, I was like, wait a minute, Datrian could sing blues lyrics on top of my instrumental record. Maybe this could be, and it worked like a charm. You know, I would do a little prep and figure out which songs would go with which pieces of music and then hand them to him. Sometimes I would play him some of the original melodies. Sometimes I would just let him completely make them his own. And we did, I think, 3 sessions. And, you know, like a total of like maybe 8 hours tops. And then I remassaged the songs and then eventually played more guitar to finish the record off. And that became Dead Blues. And it was really, my dad used to say, trust the process, you know? And I do believe in that. Just keep working, you know, make a little progress on whatever music you feel in the day, every day, just work and just keep pushing and keep working. And then eventually, hopefully everything finds a home and a purpose.
Yes, indeed. How is the how's the album been received so far?
Man, to be honest, I'm not surprised because Datrian is a truly exceptional singer. And we've got some wonderful reviews, man. We got 4 stars in Downbeat and Relics Magazine kept mentioning it and just fantastic reviews. And another interesting lesson for me is that because the tracks were designed to be instrumental, they're more interesting than what I would normally have on a record, band track wise. You know, usually we're playing and singing together and they all kind of just join each other and accompany each other. And it's more organic and just a humble presentation. But yes, these, sir. You know, these were like put together, you know, over multiple years and designed to stand alone as instrumental tracks. So then when you put the vocal on top of it, it's like, whoa, it's like a whole nother level for me as a arranger and producer, you know?
Sure. So what's next for Luther Dickinson and the North Mississippi All-Stars, man? What you got cooking?
Man, well, we are working on another project. I don't want to divulge too much because...
Okay, all right.
But it's definitely a beautiful little sidestep. We have a next year is the 30th anniversary. We're in that era where like every year is the anniversary of something because we've messed around and got so old, man. I'm 52. It's the 30th anniversary of the conception of the band next year.
Wow.
And so yeah, we've got a bunch of things in store and I've just been writing and writing new music and recording, you know, a little bit every day.
How does it feel to know that the band has stood the test of time? I mean, truly, you guys are just still rocking and rolling, man.
We're so fortunate. We appreciate every single person that buys the ticket and supports us in any way, man. You know,
indeed.
It's you just got to keep the faith, you know. I mean, to be honest, it's a hard business and it's not easy, but it's worth it, you know. Music makes us feel so good that we can put up with all the negative side of the business and the lifestyle and what it takes to do it full time. And, you know, we're totally, you know, we're just working, man. But I find the harder I work, the better the music is. You know, like in the days when I was more pampered and had a bus and a crew, and it isolates you. And then all of a sudden you step out and you're supposed to translate, communicate with a room full of people, and you've been completely isolated all day. But I feel like the harder I work and the more active I am in the whole process of putting on a presentation, the more ready I am to communicate to whoever wants to come.
There you go. All right, Luther, most important question of this interview, where can people go to find out more about you? Maybe buy some of those CDs, vinyl, or merch, or book you for a gig.
Let's go, man. You know, I got to say, your introduction is better than my Wikipedia page, man. That was super thorough. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, man. I'm sure AI will lead you there. You know, NorthMississippiAllStars.com, LutherDickinson.com, all of the above, you know.
And we will make sure to put all that information on the information section for this interview. But Luther Dixon, I want to wish you continued success, sir. Thank you so much for joining me today on Time Signatures. And anytime you need a microphone, be it for a new album or a tour or other big news, you get in touch. We'll get you on here, okay?
Thank you so much, Jim.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Luther Dickinson, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.